As a teenager growing up in Baghdad, Dr. Mujahid Al-Mudarris was used to seeing people with terrible wounds from the decade-long Iran-Iraq war. He imagined being able to help the amputees walk again using robotics, inspired, believe it or not, by Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie Terminator. Today, as a pioneering orthopedic surgeon, he's truly making that dream a reality. But so much has happened in the meantime. Early in his career, the Saddam Hussein regime ordered doctors at Mujahid's hospital on threat of summary execution to breach their Hippocratic oaths by mutilating deserters. Instead, Mujahid Al-Mudarris escaped Iraq, becoming a refugee who eventually arrived by boat and with the help of people smugglers at Christmas Island. Then he became detainee number 982, spending 10 grueling months at the Curtin Detention Centre in remote Western Australia before being granted refugee status. Mujahid Al-Mudarris re-established his medical career in Australia, and today he is a leader in the field of osseointegration, which involves attaching prosthetic robotic limbs to the bones of amputees, limbs that the brain can control and move. His latest book, Going Back, is the story of Mujahid's return to Iraq to change the lives of injured soldiers and civilians. Dr. Mujahid Al-Mudarris, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what was The Year That Made You? Which year have you selected?
Well, The Year That Made Me is 1999, basically. It's that year that transformed my life from being, you know, a very comfortable young doctor, growing up as a spoiled brat with a silver spoon in my mouth.
I mean, you were almost literally royalty.
Well, basically, my family come from blue blood. They were second to the Iraqi throne. And
So actually royalty.
So they were of a noble class in Iraq, yeah. If you can classify nobility in that country. But they belong from, you know, the descendant of Muhammad, the prophet. And regardless of the social class, regardless of the education, if you are a descendant of the prophet Muhammad, you are treated with kind of a different level of respect. And being educated, so you either become a doctor, a lawyer, or an army officer, and otherwise you're in trouble with your family.
But then things changed forever on one particular day in Baghdad Hospital.
So that particular day, I parked my car, went to the theatre complex to do my job as a junior resident in surgery. All of a sudden, everything changed. We were confronted with Ba'ath Party members and Republican guards escorting 3 busloads of army deserters. And they ordered us to abandon the elective list and start mutilating these army deserters by chopping part of their ears off. The head of the department refused openly, and he said, "This is against the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm." And they dragged him outside to the car park, put a bullet in his head in front of everybody, and then turned to the rest of us. They said, "Anyone share this man's view, come forward."
You must have been terrified.
It was, I mean, time passed very quickly there because there was no time to think. And I had to make a very quick decision. Should I obey the commands and live with guilt for the rest of my life by violating every single principle I was brought up on? Should I refuse and end up with a bullet in my head? Because that's how it works over there. If you disobey Saddam's ruling, you get killed. As simple as that. Or should I run away? And I managed to hide in the female toilets. I escaped from the theater complex. And my life changed upside down from a very privileged, spoiled brat, someone who hasn't seen a hardship in his life, to someone who's escaping from the law, escaping from the government, and in fear of losing my life if I get caught. My family had to prepare a passport for me, and they got me a large sum of money, and they managed to smuggle me through the borders to Jordan.
From Jordan, you made your way to Malaysia. How did you do that?
So basically, Jordan was not safe back then, and I didn't have a visa over there. And the only place that would give an Iraqi national with half-decent passport a visa was Malaysia. And I thought, this is the only place I can go to. So I took the flight. And then coincidences happened where I met 2 young men in Abu Dhabi airport, and I could speak English a little bit back then. So I helped them with interpreting, and they found me useful. So they were happy to take me with them, and I discovered that they were seeking asylum somewhere. And in return for me providing the service of translation. They had access to a phone number of a people smuggler. So we dialed the number, and that was Mehdi, the smuggler, who received us. He looked like Steve Irwin, basically. He was blonde, blue eyes. And he took us aside and he said, give me this amount of money, which was significant, and give me your passport. I'll get back to you with your next destination. I was very skeptical, and I said, how do you expect me to trust you with my money and passport that you would come back tomorrow? And he got really offended, and he said, how dare you question my credibility? I'm a respectable smuggler. I mean, it didn't make any sense. Anyway, we had no choice. We gave him the passport and the money. He came back the next day with visas to Indonesia, with first-class tickets to Jakarta, with Garuda Airlines. And
so he was good to his word.
So he was a man of his word, and he was more than being respectable. He was very accurate. Mm. He gave us instructions of how to go through the airport, and he said, don't go to the covered woman, don't go to the guy with a beard, don't go to the guy that has too many stars, go to the guy with one star on his shoulder, give him your passport, make sure you put $100 inside the passport, and he will let you through. And I questioned him again. I said, are you really expecting me to bribe a custom officer in a major international airport? And he looked at me and he said, yes, do you have a problem with that? And I thought, well, I better shut up. It was exactly as he described it, and it went very smooth. He gave us another number of another people smuggler, and that was Omid the smuggler this time. And I met him in the hotel, an hour drive from the airport. He said, I prayed to God that God will provide me with an imam or religious leader, and I prayed to God that God will provide me with a doctor. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense. And he said, well, the imam will come from Iran, and he will have, you know, a piece of clay that's brought from Karbala, which is the holy land in southern, well, middle Iraq, mm-hmm. south of Baghdad. And that's mixed with the Prophet Muhammad's grandson's blood. And he will sprinkle dust from that clay on the sea, and it will calm the waters because I have a brand new boat going to Australia. And that was the first time for me to know that Australia was on the map as in a destination. Mm. And he said, but I have a problem, and the problem is that the imam has a fully pregnant daughter, and I need someone to look after the daughter so the imam get concentrating on calming the waters.
So it was your qualification as a doctor that got you a spot on the boat.
And I said, okay, well, I'll do that. I'll take that opportunity. And we got on the boat, and turned up that the boat was leaky. It was not even seaworthy. And we were crammed like sardines vertically, 165 of us.
165.
And as soon as we got to international waters, the Indonesian skipper stopped the boat, and there was a grey ship with white numbers written on it tailing us, came very close, and a black dinghy came from that ship and joined the boat. And with broken English, the Indonesian skipper said, straight Christmas Island, miss 2 weeks mainland, I go home, goodbye. And he jumped on the dinghy and left us to face the element on our own. The boat journey was horrific. It was very rough sea, and a lot of these people from Middle Eastern background never seen a sea before. Mm. So they were crammed in the main hall, which was a fishing boat, basically, where they suffocated from the fumes. And I was hopeless, basically, because by the end of the day, people were lying down on top of each other. And no matter how much fluid I injected in them through the drips, that didn't work because they were vomiting all the time. But if you ask me the question, would I do it again if I'm in the same situation? You bet I would, because I had no other choice. And that's what politicians don't understand, or a lot of politicians don't understand, is that people get on the boat not for fun. They get on these boats because they're desperate and because there is no other solution. And, you know, I didn't go through any country that is a signatory to the Refugee Convention, Article 1951. And if I go to Malaysia or Indonesia to a UNHCR, you know, office or to an embassy, I will get arrested and get sent back to where I come from and get killed, basically.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Mujahid Almodarris. Mujahid, you ended up in a detention camp in Australia. What was the experience of being a detainee in Australian detainee centre like?
When we first got to Australia, we got to Christmas Island, and Christmas Island was not a detention centre. We were received by the federal police, and they were very kind, very generous, and they looked after us. They gave us change of clothes, and they allowed us warm showers. I still vividly remember it. But everything changed as soon as we got to the detention centre. Curtin Detention Centre was literally hell on earth. I was stripped of my human identity. I was marked with a permanent marker on my shoulder with a number 982. I was called by that number for the time I spent in the detention center, and the treatment was absolutely atrocious. I was a naughty boy, obviously. I was singled out as a troublemaker, and as a result of that, I had the pleasure of visiting many Western Australian prisons, including maximum security jail. And I can tell you, the prison system in Western Australia is absolutely superb. I recommend it to everyone. It was a pleasure comparatively. I was treated with dignity. The prison officers were so kind. They called me by my name, which means a lot. Mm-hmm. I was given proper food, proper bed, and I could have access to media, television, newspapers. I could send letters, receive letters, and I could make a phone call, which I didn't have access to in the detention center. And as a result of me going to jail, that may have expedited my release, if anything, because I had access to a telephone. I managed to contact people. I managed to hire a lawyer, and I managed to get legal representation. Mm. While I was in the detention center, I didn't have access to anything. And there was no way. And at some stage, miraculously, my name dropped off the legal representation, because I wasn't given processing officer.
Right. So there was like a bureaucratic hitch that meant that you were not part of the processing.
Well, basically, I call it like the sands that drops in the hourglass, and you know, numbers were going trickling after the Sydney Olympics, and people were processed, and 980 was processed, 981 was processed, 983 was processed, 984 was processed, and 1,252 was processed, which is the end of the camp, and I was not.
So what did that mean for you?
So I was left in limbo. And funny enough, you know, you move from a locked environment, because when they started processing people, they put us in one side of the camp, and then one by one, after they get processed, they move them to the other side, and they cannot mix with the people who are not processed for some reason or another. Maybe so people don't tell what experience they had right with the processing. And basically, the hourglass sand moved from one end to the other, and I was the only grain that stayed on the other side.
And you were in solitary confinement for how long?
So I spent 40 days in solitary confinement, and they put me in this place called the suicide watch box, which was a box, like literally 1.5 by 2.5 meter box, mattress on the floor, no sheets, no pillows. There was no window. And every time I ask, what am I doing here? And they say, oh, we're rehabilitating you because you spent time in jail. And jail was fantastic. And I said to them, take me back to jail. I loved it there. And I had to go on a hunger strike to get access to my only companion that came with me from Iraq, which is the book that I brought, Last Anatomy. So I studied the book from cover to cover again and again several times. And thanks to the Department of Immigration, when I was released and I sat my anatomy exam, I scored very high.
Oh, you were well and truly ready to go. That meant, of course, you've experienced becoming a doctor twice. First in Iraq, and then the second time around in a different country, a different language. Were you readily accepted into the medical community?
In my welcome dinner, in joining the most prestigious, or one of the most prestigious specialties in Australia, which is the orthopedic training program, to my face, two of my peer said loud and clear that, isn't it a shame that the Australian orthopedic training program standards drop so low to allow a refugee to be one of us? And that was the turning point in my life. So if you ask me, what was the year that made you? I could say 2 years. That point was another turning point in my life, because that was a wake-up call for me. I realized that I should turn back again and not turn my back to my past. Mm. My past is what made me.
Because, so that's why you advocate for refugees and asylum seekers.
So as a result of that, I thought that I wasted time by not working hard on fighting discrimination, fighting hate.
And your medical work spans both that, looking forward into the future of high technology and robotics with your osseointegration techniques, but also you do look back to your past and you don't forget that past because you go back to Iraq and do medical work there as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the span of those experiences?
Well, look, I mean, my day-to-day work in Australia is doing hip and knee surgery, and it's boring like batshit, believe me. But what I feel that I can contribute more is that I'm familiar with developing countries, and it's not exclusive to Iraq. I've been to Cambodia, been to Lebanon, Jordan, and many other developing countries, including the United States of America. And I even go and help out in many developed countries like Germany, Israel, Holland, Canada, Switzerland, many other places. So we have programs running in both sides of the world, the developing and the developed. So I strongly believe that we can make a difference. And people say, oh, I mean, you know, you're going to Iraq or Cambodia, it's a drop in the ocean helping one or two patients or 100 patients. I disagree with that, because if you help one person, that person will help another person and it will snowball and other people will follow. And I was told by a guy who's regarded as a terrorist, actually. He's the head of the Hashd, or the paramilitary in Iraq. And he's a wise guy, basically. I think he's on the terrorist list of the Americans, but he's controlling the government in Iraq at the moment. He said to me one thing. He said, do you know why I would bring you here? And I said, why do you bring me here? Because he's the head of the paramilitary, one of the biggest, sections of the government. He said, we don't care whether you treat one or two or 100 people. What we care about is that you're giving people hope. Okay, by coming here and operating. And, you know, regardless of who this guy is and what he does, these words mean something because it does make sense.
Well, 1999 obviously created huge change for you, but there have been beneficiaries all around the world because of that. We do ask our guests on the year that made me to think of a piece of music. What song have you chosen to represent 1999 for Mujahid Almodarris?
Well, it's maybe in the same era, but the song that played a big role in my life and every time I listen to I get goosebumps is The Winds of Change by Scorpions. And that meant a lot to us because we were going through the era of the Iron Curtain collapsing. Yep. And a huge change in the world and the fear that people have of, you know, nuclear war and the elimination of the human mankind, which we were on the brink of. Mm. So that song meant a lot to me, and especially that it was released in 1991, pretty much 3 days after the invasion or the bombing of Iraq, and I could listen to it back then. So it does bring back a lot of memories.
Dr. Mujahid Almodarris, thank you so much for being our guest today. And here's Scorpion with The Wind of Change.
Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.
we could be so close, like brothers.